pull this chair up.
Yeah, just whatever you.
Now I have the tape recorder on now just to make sure that it's recording us. Thank you very much. So I guess we're ready to begin.
Well, maybe you'd want to ask questions, or do you want to?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Maybe we'd start by you telling me a little bit about before the strike, about where and when you both were born.
Oh yes. Well, I was born in North Dakota in 1882. And I lived in North Dakota until 1906, and then I was married and came out to Seattle.
Were you married to someone from Seattle?
No, I married a former North Dakotan. I had been attending the university here and graduated in pharmacy, and we were married at the end of his pharmacy course. Came back and got married in North Dakota. And we came to Seattle, and he lived in Ballard. It was Ballard then, Seattle, it was a separate town. But in 1907, it was annexed by Seattle. So after that, it was Seattle, although they called it the Ballard Post Office. And Ballard Business District. And my husband had worked for others, first for Preston Drug Company, Preston Drug Store, and then he worked for Mr. Horn for what they called the Cascade Drug Company. And then he bought the Cascade Drug Company and had it in Ballard for over.
What? From 1946.
From 1910.
Well, that'd be what? That'd be 46 and 10 to 36 years.
And then he retired, and we have lived here in this home since 1912. And he passed away in 1970.
So he originally, you both came out here because he had done his college studying.
Yes, he had been a teacher in North Dakota and wanted to get something more permanent, so he came to Seattle in 1901.
He arrived in Seattle with $5 in his pocket.
What had his folks and your folks done?
Beg your pardon?
What did his parents do?
Well, his parents, my parents, and his parents, both families, came from Iceland in the earlier years. My mother came in 1876 to this country, to Canada, and then into the United States in 1979.
No, hold her. 1879.
1818, yeah. Yes. And but his parents, or father, came in 1883. And we were both in the same community, of course, living.
Was that a farming community? Is that what people did there?
Oh, yes. It was a farming community in Pembina County in North Dakota. And there's quite an influx of Icelandic people, so it became kind of more of an Icelandic community than a really, you know, mixture.
Mm-hmm.
And our nearest town was Cavalier, North Dakota. And my father had a grocery store and a post office started. There was no post office when he came. And it was called Accra, A-K-R-A, Accra, North Dakota. And he had this general store and farming and so did most everybody else, have either a little business or a farm.
And so, Mr. Johansson, you were born here in Seattle?
Yeah, I was born in Ballard, yeah. And I was born after Seattle, Ballard became a community of Seattle, part of Seattle.
Yes.
What was Seattle like then, compared to now?
Well, Seattle was rather primitive looking, although it was a big city to me, who had never been in a big city. But one
still thing, remembers the mud on the streets and
the mud on the streets because there were no pavements and no nothing but wooden sidewalks. And there were trestles, and most of them there were trestles that they were up above the ground. They were kind of sloughs in between so that things would fall right through. But what struck me when I first came was it looked so, the lot of land, it looked so horrible. When I came in on the train and we went through miles and miles of logged off lands, nothing but big stumps.
Could you see those right from Seattle?
Well, it wasn't right in Seattle, but it was all around, say, up here in the mountains. And after I was here, took trips. Once I went out to, we went to a place they were going to start industrial central. It was somewhere on the mainland, close to Port Angeles.
Or Port Townsend, yeah.
Or Port Townsend, and my husband wanted to see it. And we took a boat and a train and a bus to get there. But it never was started. I don't remember what they were going to call it.
They were going to set up an iron producing
something like that.
Kind of industry, I think it was.
And it was the same thing. We could see the logged off lands. Seattle was always fresh and nice looking, but it was much more sparse looking out here on this end of the city. There were patches of no homes. Where we are now, there were no homes when we first came. It was just sand hills. But on the parts of it, there had been little additions put up and houses built below 70. Of course, the sawmills were very much in evidence then. There were many sawmills. I don't remember how many there were when I came first. And the saloons were on every corner, practically.
There wasn't much shipbuilding then, was there? Or?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they did much shipbuilding until in the war. Then everything seemed to start and people were working on that. That was the First World War.
Mm-hmm. Skinner Nibby shipyard.
Well, there was
that shipyard, the Skinner Nibby shipyard.
Yeah, that was bigger than Seattle during World War One.
Then there was one out here on the beach here. What was the name of
that? Trigoni.
Yeah, Trigoni.
Yeah, very small, just a boatyard rather than a shipyard.
Of course, the beach down there was very nice. It was very, open and nothing really going on. Like now, it's all filled up with something.
So did the shipyards make a big difference in Seattle?
Well, I think it helped a lot in the work. But the sawmills were the big thing in those days. Mm-hmm. Everybody seemed to depend on the sawmills, even if they had strikes and trouble. Then they just come back, but I had an uncle that worked in the sawmills, and he, had trouble. He had accidents, had lost most of his fingers on one hand, but there was never any injury.
recompense.
Recompense, or the state did nothing for them, and they just go back to work. And then after that, they began to take them outside of the city, you know, and put up mills here and there. And they,
closer to the trees.
But of course, the Stimson mill was here for a long time, and so was the, what was it called, the one by the bridge?
Well, a Phoenix, but I forget the full title of Phoenix. It was a Phoenix, yeah. But no, a Seattle Cedar.
Yeah, a Seattle Cedar,
yeah,
that
Seattle
was
Cedar,
the,
yeah.
That lasted the, about the longest.
So most of the people who came to your husband's drugstore, most of the people who shopped at your husband's drugstore, they were people who worked in the mills?
Yes. Or also fishermen.
I worked, we lived in Ballard, closer to Ballard first, and every afternoon we'd see the shingle weavers coming up the street with a bundle of boards on their back. Everybody walked, they didn't take cars.
Uh-huh.
But I can remember that. That was kind of a difference to me, to see those men walking up the hill with a bundle of little boards on their back.
Because a lot of his customers were also were in fishing or, you know, in sea occupation. Particularly among the Scandinavians, there were a lot of fishermen among them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he had a very good following of Scandinavians who were really numerical. Know people of Scandinavian descent then, especially Norwegians.
Mm-hmm. So, your husband had gone to college. Had you also gone to high school?
Well, I didn't go to college. I went to what they called an academy after just general elementary school in the country. I went to an academy in Minnesota for a term.
Uh-huh.
The one, what is it, 1 year?
1 year.
And you, Mr. Johansson, did you go to school here in Seattle?
Yeah, I went to school in Seattle entirely. I went to the university.
You went to the University of Washington?
Yeah.
In Seattle?
Yeah.
What did you study there?
Well, I took several things. I started in liberal arts and finished liberal arts and took the majors in advertising and business administration and teaching.
Uh-huh. That's a nice school.
Yeah, it's a large school. It was getting bigger and bigger now, and it's starting to shrink a little bit, I guess.
His university was not very big at the time that my husband came out. And it was, yes, I think it had moved. From where it was originally.
You're originally downtown, I think. Downtown.
Down where they.
A lot of the downtown buildings are on the former campus, you know. Some of the principal buildings in Seattle were on the original campus, and they're revenue producing ever since.
Uh-huh.
But he was always very happy that he had come out here. And he had such a good teachers that they really made things very interesting and helped him up through his student days. And then he worked part of the time in a drugstore in the university district for experience for Mr. Asherman.
How did it happen that he came so far to school that he came all the
way? Well, for one thing, it didn't help. The courses in he did attend the University of North Dakota for a year, but they didn't have this course that he wanted, this pharmacy course. And he had been teaching, so he decided that he had known someone that had gone out here and had formed a good opinion about Seattle, so he started off in 1901. And he said that the teachers were very kind to him, and he got along very well.
Was it strange for you to come to?
Well, in a way it was. It was very interesting. It was, I had never been in a big city live where there were so many people, and people were very kind and very friendly. And I even had this uncle and aunt that lived here, had lived here for since 1889, and were old timers as far as Seattle. They were here the year of the fire, that's when they came. And I had two uncles that had been here, that had gone. One had gone to California, and the other one had gone back to North Dakota. So it was not an entirely, you know, unknown country.
Mm-hmm.
And they had written to my family, and I knew what they were. But I guess the times were pretty hard at times. They had depressions. Work wasn't too much. One of my uncles had a grocery store down on Bennyway for a while.
And also down here on 61.
Not the one, not that
not
uncle.
Not the same one, though.
No, the other uncle had that.
Mm-hmm.
A little grocery store here on 67th and 26th. But there was a group of people here that was really the Icelandic group that really kept pretty close together and were very social. Cooperated. We even had church or religious meetings, but they didn't have a church. But we'd go to either the Norwegian church or the Swedish church. There were so many churches in Ballard. There was one for each nationality: Swedish, Danish, German, Finnish. So you could take your. And then they would have the different branches. There were Lutheran and Methodist. Not very many other, except the, what do you call it, the Pentecostal?
Yeah, the Catholic.
Oh yes, and the Catholic.
Were the services in English in those different churches, or did each church do it in?
In their own language, yeah. In the national language. So we were really very, had many churches to go to, and of course they'd have them in other, in the English part sometimes.
Well, did they have the services in Icelandic church in Icelandic?
They didn't have a church in Icelandic.
Well,
they
about,
had the hall.
Yeah, well, what about the meetings? Were they?
Sure, they were conducted
were they
in Icelandic.
They were Icelandic.
At least, you know, occasionally they'd have English, and they'd have programs too. And they were very active, and they tried to have a choir and have social meetings for the people.
Were those meetings all the people from the Icelandic community, the businessmen as well as
well,
the
yes, they were all they were very social. They kept together. There weren't so very many, but they kept together and they kept up a. They formed a little society that they called Vestry. And it was a kind of a
literary society.
Literary. They had a library, bought books, and kept the library and in touch with the old country. And then, of course, they, at the same time, they were interested in what was going on. There were political connections, too. We had a man by the name of Sigurdsson, Reverend J.A. Sigurdsson. And he came from North Dakota, same year as my husband. And he became very interested in politics. And he worked with the Judge Dyckman for some years. You know, that was the first of the juvenile court, when they first started the juvenile court. And this Judge Dyckman, he was in the office as a juvenile officer. I don't remember just what they called it, but this Sigurdsson, he was there, worked there weekdays, and then Sundays he'd have services in that little hall. They had a hall on 14th and 67th, I think.
No, was it 64th, wasn't it?
No,
it wasn't. It a block above where the Gerson did?
Well, it was a block.
It wouldn't be 67th, it'd be not the 64th.
Well, it may be that it was 64, but it wasn't on 65th. It hadn't come.
No.
I'm not sure of it because...
Unless they moved it to a different, to a second level.
They sold it and it didn't, they didn't keep up. Then the Depression came and so many of the people went back east, went back to Saskatchewan, took up farming and took homesteads.
Which depression is this?
And what?
What depression?
About 1905.
Mm-hmm.
So then things kind of came down into a standstill because there weren't very many. And not very many from the United States. If they came out here, they'd come through Canada. They'd come to Canada first and then come to Canada, to Seattle. I had an uncle that was born in 1850, and he came to America and he was interested in trying to get a place in Alaska, that the Icelanders could have a real community of their own. And he even was given a trip to Alaska by the government, by President Grant, and to look over the country. And he did, he liked it, but after he came back, he went to Washington, D.C. and tried to interest Congress in this, help them, because the distance was so far that many of them couldn't afford to come all the way to the West Coast after they got into the United States or Canada. Well, it fell down, nothing came of it, and they settled in the Midwest. They settled in Manitoba and North Dakota and Minnesota. And that's where they still have communities that are very, very social and very compact with the Icelandic people. And of course now, these communities have been, started in British Columbia and here of people that had no way to buy farms. There were no farms to be had. The young people couldn't take farms. They'd have to buy them or couldn't even buy them in 1905. So that's the time they started to go to Saskatchewan. And they took up land there and formed quite big communities. And they still have them, but they tell me that there are more Ukrainians now in those places than Icelanders. And they, of course, mixed with the Americans more or less. They say the Canadians come over a lot to live here.
Let me ask you some questions about the strike.
Well, if I can give you any information.
Uh-huh. Well, mostly questions about how you saw
it. Of course, most of it would be by hearsay, and of course through the papers. But as far as I can remember, there wasn't very much to going on. And as far as I remember, there were no bad incidents or people hurt, or that we read about it, but as far as daily lives, it didn't affect us at all. And I never heard anybody that had to go to work downtown that they complained of any mishaps. And of course, we knew about it, but that's about all. But as I said before, that I went back to North Dakota to visit that year, and some of my relatives there were asking me if I knew Ole Hansen. And I said, no, I didn't know him, but I knew all about him. And they were saying what a horrible time we had had, or he had had, and with the people in Seattle. And I said, I didn't know about that. I had never heard anything like that. And kind of deflated his image with some of them, because they looked on him as a hero. according to what they had read, of course.
Tell them about that older man that was so interested in the strike.
Yes, he was one of my uncle's relative, and he was very interested in the strike, and he felt that Ole Hansen had really been a hero. And of course, I couldn't say no that he wasn't, but I had never heard anything very outstanding. Nobody was cowering inside of locked doors, when, as far as I know. Everybody seemed to go around, whether the streetcars were stopped, I didn't remember that. Because this car came, you know, ran right by here, and I don't even remember that it made any much difference as far as we were concerned.
Did people of time think of it as, or the people you know, what did people think about it? Did they think it was a strike or a revolution?
Here?
Or,
you
yeah,
mean here?
People here?
Well, I really didn't hear many people talk about it. There wasn't much discussion about it. I knew of a young fellow. I heard that he was going to make a little money driving a jiffy, 5 cents a fare, downtown.
Because the streetcars weren't running there?
Yeah, at the time. And then later he had said that he didn't make anything. It didn't last for nothing. People didn't patronize him, and he really didn't make any money on it. But I guess they did. Some of them had these jiffy routes, you know, took people downtown to help them.
Why do you think the strike was called? Why did it happen?
Well, it may be that they weren't paid. And of course, Stone Webster, who had the streetcars, I really don't know the ins and outs of it, of what really was the object of it. But they had the streetcars, and I think it was lack of service that people didn't get or need what they wanted.
But I think the situation is confused. You say strike. Well, I've been reading a little bit about it, and there was a strike in Seattle on July the 17th. 1917, and that was a streetcar, and it was a streetcar strike. That was a streetcar strike, and that is because of what the wages were support.
Uh-huh.
And that is just a couple years. That is less than 2 years before the general strike.
I think in the during the general strike, the streetcars also stopped running.
They stopped for several days in the complex. Sorry,
uh-huh.
All stopped. That's not to my own knowledge, but I saw that in print.
Uh-huh.
I saw a book by a fellow named Hanford that was discussed it briefly, and it mentioned that they all, on February the 6th, everybody, it all stopped. All the streetcars stopped running, and the restaurants closed, and some of the hotels closed, and so on.
But it didn't affect life out here in Ballard?
No.
No, not that I know about. Although I imagine that people had to go to work. But as I say, I think it was jiffy, the car, or what do they call it, jiffy drivers.
Well, because they had jiffy drivers here over a period of many years. There was as late as 1921 or so, so that it isn't just then that they had jiffies to sweep the streets and take the cream of the traffic away from the transit system.
Uh-huh. Let me stop just a moment to make sure that there's still some tape left here. It is running up.
My husband said, you know, the service wasn't too good about Ballard in the earlier days. And he said that when he was in the university, he'd walk over here to Ballard instead of going on the buses or the streetcars, because he'd have to go downtown first and then come to Ballard. They didn't have any direct service.
Mm-hmm.
So he would walk over here.
Mm-hmm.
And he also used to walk to work, to his drugstore, which is about a little over a mile from here.
Well, that was when he was going to the university, when he
was
when
he had his own drugstore. And in 1917, he was walking to Ballard, both ways, but to and from, so he wouldn't have noticed the absence of streetcars.
Well, he didn't walk in the evening if he could get a car, because after they're off there late, he could have late hours, you know, in the drugstore.
But during the strike, and the only difference for him was walking.
Oh, it was not impossible to walk.
Walked customarily anyway, so that
we used to do that, you know, if the service wasn't good, we'd just walk uphill all the way, and it just taking more time.
Mm-hmm. How did you get your information about the strike?
Well, I imagine we saw it, or I saw it in the papers.
There were no radios then.
The
papers weren't being published. As I understand, the newspapers were all discontinued.
Oh?
They did have some trouble. I think one day the Star got out one edition, but most of the time they were having a lot of trouble getting the papers out.
Well, evidently now these people must have seen it in papers and magazines. Back in North Dakota, they couldn't
have it. It is probably the national papers and the other states that probably had the accounts more than we did out here.
Uh-huh. But there was no, was it something that people talked about? Do you remember?
I beg your pardon?
Was it something that friends talked about?
At that time?
Yeah.
No, I didn't hear very much about that. Of course, you know, when you have a family of children, and you are not with people too much. It might be with my husband that they discussed it in the drugstore, but...
But it wasn't something that you worried about your
no,
husband
no worries
get out
at all.
Weapons or anything
no,
like that?
No, no worries. And I never heard of any incidents that were, horrible or upsetting
mm-hmm.
to those that were working. And of course, a good many of them were working in the mills. At that time, our friends, here in Ballard, they didn't require any streetcar.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, they used to walk home from work with their bundles of shingles on their back.
You said before that you knew of Ole Hansen, although you didn't know him. Did you know any of the other people in the place? Did you know Anna Louise Strong?
Oh yes, I read about Anna Lou Strong. She was quite a character, strong character.
How do you mean that?
Well, she was a woman liberal, I'd call her a woman liberal woman now. She stood up for her, what she wanted, and was quoted in many ways. Well, I never met her personally.
But do you remember when they had a campaign to recall her from the school board? I think she was on the school board, and some people didn't like her being left-wing.
Her left-wing. Oh, I imagine that she had...
Oh, do you recall the recall campaign?
No, I don't. Do you know what year that was?
I guess around 1916 or so.
You know,
a little later.
We couldn't vote in those days, you know that, except in school elections. When I first came to Seattle, we didn't have the liberty to vote. And I didn't vote until they allowed women to come to the polls.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Do you remember Hewlett Wells? Hewlett Wells?
Hewlett, no, I never heard of Hewlett Wells.
Or Harry Alt, I think he was the editor of the Union Record.
Oh, my husband, he took the Union Record.
Was that the only paper he read, the Union
Record? Oh, no. He took the PI always.
And also the
Star. Not so much at times then, but later.
But you did have the Union Record.
Yes, and I imagine that he sold all the papers at the drugstore.
Mm-hmm.
Even the language, the Swedish paper and the Norwegian paper and the Danish paper.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember people talking about the strike after it ended.
With what?
What people said about the strike after it ended.
Well, I imagine they were kind of relieved, whatever the trouble was, that there was more, you know. Then, of course, after I heard more about Ole Hansen afterwards, after he went to California and built up this big community of his, isn't that St. Clemente?
Right.
I remember I've seen that. I went to California once and I saw it. A very attractive community with the red roofs.
What did people think about Ole Hansen then around here?
Well, I don't know. I think they kind of felt that he had not represented things as they were, that he was biased. That's what I had felt, that he had used his influence.
Mr. Jones, do you remember the strike at all?
No, just very vaguely. I may remember that the, maybe some rumor talk that I heard, maybe some of the my young associates, but just a very vague picture of it. And I have a picture in my mind that told you something about the streets I used to run across on north of 67th and. I have some recollection of seeing a, I don't know, it's a vague, I really you can't give much of a picture, whether there was a talk about a strike or strike breakers or violence toward the streetcar or something like that, but it really doesn't amount to any firm impression.
You don't remember, there was a day in the strike when the army came in. Do you remember when the troops actually came into Seattle
and
marched down
the American troops?
No, I think he is the National Guard, didn't he?
Oh.
I think it was the National Guard.
Oh, yeah.
I think Ole Hansen called the National Guard.
No, I don't
remember. I don't recall it, because my memory is not as good as hers. And I might have realized at that time, but I've forgotten it by now, but her memory is much sharper. And she has a better memory for recollection than I do.
You don't remember then, after the strike was over, people being mad at labor or sympathetic to labor, or do you feel that it, in any way it changed how people looked at labor at the time?
Well, I imagine that our friends were mostly laborers, so that they would be the ones that would be either jubilant about the winning the strike or losing it, because most of the people around here were really laborers. They were not businessmen. There were very few businessmen among the here in our vicinity.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that was Uncle Sleen Bjornson, was he in Dallas at that time?
Oh, he was in Dallas a long time.
But then was he around at that particular time?
At 1919, February 1919. Well, as I say, they mills went out of Seattle, and after that, they had to go up wherever the mills were running.
We may have not been in Seattle at that time.
And he went up to Big Lake, and he went up to other Snoqualmie and
Markham and Ocean.
No, and then later he went out to the ocean, you know, across the near Aberdeen.
Oh, so he probably wasn't in Ballard at all at the time of the
I doubt fighting. That he was very close to Ballard.
He was a labor man, and he was a strong union man. And so on.
Well, he was not a strong union man.
Well, he was a very strong labor man.
Yes, he was very strong, and he felt that the laboring man didn't have the right, you know, treatment. When he came to things like if they were hurt or had to go on a strike, no help from anybody, they never got any recompense.
This may be hard if you remember, but do you remember your friends who were laborers feeling any differently about being laborers after the strike, did they feel a change?
Well, I really don't remember that there was much talk about it. There weren't very many. There weren't so very many young people among my friends then. That was after, you see, they had gone to Canada. A good many of the younger people had gone to Canada. But after a few years, they came back, or after the 20s, they came back from Canada and settled here.
Well, George Goodwin probably worked for the Street Railway, didn't he? During that period, wouldn't you say?
Oh, no, he wasn't, yes.
1919? You have no recollection of his attitude.
No.
He was a carman for the city. He was a conductor, rather.
A conductor.
He was
they
employed
had two
probably
men
at that
couch.
Time, but you don't remember his.
No, I never remember that he complained about any trouble. It was only after they had only one man on the bus or the street cars that he gave it up, you know, because he didn't want to be a motorman.
Because he had a lot of trouble after that, and not getting paid and getting paid by warrants, which meant that they didn't get their cash, but they got a warrant from the city, and that was after the strike, I mean.
Yes, that was
interesting.
Let me ask you about some things that happened way after the strike. What sort of organizations did you belong to later?
We?
Did you, your husband, belong to any sort of organization?
Well, he of course belonged to the pharmacist, and he belonged to the Eagles.
And you all?
No, yes, I think he did for a while. But,
Did either of you ever belong to the political organization?
Oh, yes. He belonged to the Democratic. And I was a Democratic first woman for 25 years.
Uh-huh.
So, I met a lot of the Democrats.
Uh-huh. How did you feel about the civil rights movement when it started?
You mean for the black people?
Uh-huh.
Well, I feel now that there wasn't much discussion about that in the earlier years, as far as I remember. But I have always been for it. They should have their rights.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about the anti-Vietnam War movement? The movement against the war in Vietnam when that was going on.
Well, I didn't really take sides in that. I felt that was up to the Congress and the President to decide about that.
And how do you feel now about the women's movement?
Well, I'm a kind of in favor of women, but I'm afraid that they have to be careful not to overdo it.
How do you mean overdo it?
Well, to be too aggressive. Because they want to get into everything that the men are doing. Well, they can't do that. They can't do the things that men do. You know, I feel that way, that it isn't. Women can't do many things that men have to do. And they can be strong and they can, use their time for what is necessary if they want to help. But not to crowd the men away, because they can't do that. They haven't got the physical strength or even the knowledge or the interest that the men have. I'm for men because men have, they have certain things that we don't have. They have strength and knowledge and better physical conditions than women to do things.
I didn't have any other questions. Is there anything else that you remember from those times that affected the church?
Well, of course, I have I have read a great deal about, for instance, the people that I come from, and in many ways they are strong people. They have been very independent, the Icelanders, and individualists. But the men have had been the stronger element, you know. Women have had to, and yet the women in Iceland had more earlier voting than we had here in the United States. Mm-hmm. But of course, the primitive life was very hard on both men and women, but especially the women, because they were poor, many poor people, very poor, and big families, and but they, of course, that's the way that many of the women just, you know, they were just killed, died from overwork. And of course that was the thought of the family heads, but things were like that. And I think that there's a tendency now, it seems to me, that the women are a little bit too aggressive about it, that they want to you know, to take over in some ways, and they can't do it. I don't believe they can. If they're capable of carrying the things that men have, what would the men do if they were pushed out of their offices? What would they take up? I don't think that's fair to expect them to stay home and take care of the families. They have families, which seems to be a very doubtful thing. I don't know about the world population, whether it's good or bad that they're cutting down on the birth rate, but it seems that there's a lot, you know, there are lots of young people now that we used to have, which in a way, in some ways is probably the better for the children or the younger. But I'm kind of appalled as to how much there is in juvenile delinquency. It's something that wasn't, you know, so much in my youth. And we had a good life. We had a good life. We lived in the country and had good food and good. We didn't have maybe education that we should have had, but people were, you know, industrious and made good use of what they had. My father was, when he came to this country, he brought 9 relatives with him. His father had died and they had a big family. So he brought 9 relatives and he took care of them for several years. And he was the oldest in the family. And he was the oldest son, and there were several sisters and four younger brothers, and they all lived with us until they became of age and were able to work. And still he had 10 children of his own later, raised 8 of them, and left us each a farm, which was quite a thing in those days. But none of us ever went to live on them, except one or two that lived on the farm. We had all gone and left home then.